I'd like you to turn with me to Nehemiah chapter 2. We began a series in Nehemiah 3 weeks ago, and today is a bit of an abbreviated message because of other things in our service. But Nehemiah is a case study in overcoming obstacles in our lives. And so this is all about overcoming Nehemiah. The storyline of Nehemiah as he rebuilds the walls of Jerusalem is all about all the kinds of issues that you and I face in our lives. Like we looked at brokenness 2 weeks ago. We looked at overcoming challenges last week. Today, overcoming accusations. I want to talk about overcoming inertia in our lives next week because we all get stuck. But overcoming accusations. And I hope that all of us have been hurt by criticism at some point in our lives, personal criticism. And some of us, I'll include myself, have been especially hurt by false accusations against us at times in our lives. And it's these kinds of things that I hope that will nourish your heart this morning. I'm trying to figure out how to say this. I'd like Nehemiah to really become your friend in a new way this morning. If you've been the subject of false accusations or you've been seriously hurt by criticism from other people in your life, because this is what Nehemiah has to overcome next. So we pick it up in chapter 2 and verse 17. Nehemiah is now with the leaders in Jerusalem, the priests and the local officials. He has been living in Babylon, which is present-day Iraq. He's a descendant of the exiles from when the Babylonians a century earlier had destroyed Jerusalem, its temple, and its walls. Since then, the temple had been rebuilt, but the walls were still in ruin. And by God's favor that we saw last week, and a little bit of courage and a lot of faith, Nehemiah ends up back in Jerusalem to take on the impossible challenge of rebuilding those walls. And this is the first time he pulls his leadership team together in verse 17. And he said, I said to them, you see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. So come, let's rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. Let's rebuild these walls. As long as those walls were down, there were serious security issues for Jerusalem. And that in turn would affect business and commerce and the ability for the Jewish people to really regain their foothold. That's the rebuilding Jesus wants to do in every one of our lives, to bring us security from the vulnerability, our otherwise vulnerability to the devil's intrusion into our lives, to rebuild function in our lives. This is always at issue for Jerusalem. In verse 18, I also told them about the gracious hand of God that was on me and what the king had said to me. So we went through that journey last week. If you weren't here, you can read that earlier in chapter 2. Supernatural favor God gave to Nehemiah with one of the most powerful men in the world, allowing Nehemiah to return to Jerusalem to do this. So I told him about how God's hand was on me. He's helped us so far, kind of like us in 2020 in some distant parallel. God's hand's been on us so far, right? We just told you about the grace of God that's been on us, and we're going to trust him to keep going. Verse 18, the next thing we see is that all of these local leaders in Jerusalem reply, well, let's start rebuilding then. Let's start rebuilding. So they began this good work. Whew, that's hopeful news. We're going to do this. The future is at stake. Generations ahead of us are at stake. We're going to do this. Don't you like those buts, though? B-U-T, the next verse starts with that word. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? So all of a sudden, the opposition truly kicks in. And that opposition is going to come in the next few chapters in the form of discouragement and intimidation and distraction and all kinds of things. But it starts with sheer, outright accusation. What is it you think you're doing? We think you're traitors. You're rebelling against the king. Well, not a great place to start. But you'll never move forward in your life if you're a victim of what everybody thinks about you all the time. I mean, you're going to take criticism if you change. You don't grow unless you change, and if you change, you're going to take criticism. I love what Charles Spurgeon said, although it hurts. He said this, a great preacher 150 years ago. He said, get a friend to tell you your faults, or better still, welcome an enemy who will watch you keenly and sting you savagely. What a blessing such an erratic critic will be to a wise man, and what an intolerable nuisance to a fool. That is his way of saying what we're not saying today. Don't censor critics out of your life. He's saying only fools refuse ever to receive critical feedback in their lives. None of us can grow without people coaching us, giving us feedback, being our critics. I mean, it's painful, but sometimes your critics can be your best friends. They can help you see things you're blind to inside. They can help you be better at what you do. So we don't want to censor critics, because some critics are right, but here's the problem. Although some critics are right, we need to watch out for other kinds of critics who aren't necessarily right, or at least they're not 100% right. Some critics are right. That's why wise people always welcome personal feedback and criticism. But you need, when it comes to your critics, you need to watch out for, first of all, critics who have a lot to lose. And that was the case with Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arab. When the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem and deported most of the Jewish population and taken them down to Iraq, it left a vacuum politically and it left a vacuum economically. And so the Samaritans, which Sanballat was, and the Ammonites from the kingdom of Ammon just across the Jordan River nearby, and also the Arabs in that area, they swept in to fill that economic and political power vacuum. And now the proposition that the Jewish people would rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and firm up their footing again in that area was an incredible threat. They had these guys, the Ammonites, the Samaritans, the Arabs, they had an incredible amount to lose if the Jews regained their foothold here. And whenever you have people who have a lot to lose, it ought to make you a little bit suspicious about the criticism they give you. If you are unhealthy emotionally or spiritually and you start becoming healthy, you're going to find that there's people in your life who depend on your lack of health to define their role in your life. They're your enablers. They're your caregivers. And they build their identity around taking care of you. You start to grow. You start to become healthy. They have an identity crisis because your health means a lot for them to lose, right? I mean, this happens over and over again. So this is the first filter. This is one of the filters Nehemiah is going to use. It's good to have critics in your life, but be careful when your critics have a lot to lose. It's going to take away their objectivity. Number two, be careful when your critics resort to personal insults. To personal insults. Notice in verse 19, after it names these people who have a lot to lose, then it said they mocked and ridiculed us. It's an old preacher joke. I hate it. I'm ashamed to even say it, but I kind of grew up with it. When the point, before I was a preacher, I used to hear this. When the point is weak, just yell louder. And you will find when people don't have a case, but they won't let off on you, they can't argue the point, so they'll come against you personally, right? And when you have a critic that's just demeaning you, and making fun of you and insulting you, you know that there's other agendas there. You know that they can't argue the issue. And be very, very careful when you criticize other people. Do not call them names. Do not call them losers. Do not use profanity against them. Do not insult them. I mean, do not deal with the issue, but don't attack the person. And when you start being personally attacked, it is another indicator that the criticism is not totally objective that's coming your way, that there's something else there. I mean, I've had Christians non-Christians make me feel like a complete fool because I'm a Christian. Some have done it very respectfully, and they've been willing to actually talk about the issues while they make me feel stupid. You know, and I appreciate that. I'll take on a good conversation where they're not just demeaning me. I've had other non-Christians do the same, make me feel like I'm a fool, but they do it in very... When I was a graduate student, I was in a group of graduate students. I don't know how we got into this. They were filling this room, a bunch of graduate students just down the hall from my office. And man, they just ganged up on me. They were making fun of me. They were hooting and hollering. And one of my best friends in that department joined in with them. And I still remember the pain of that moment. And he later, even though he never came to Christ, he later felt so bad about that he came and asked my forgiveness. He said, "I'm sorry, I just got carried away with that group. But they were mocking me, making fun of me because I was a Christian." And you know, when people resort to that, there's other issues. Sometimes they're demonic issues. Sometimes they're agenda issues. Sometimes they're people's personal pain. And especially, not only watch out for critics who have a lot to lose and resort to personal insults, but especially watch out for critics who don't deal with the issue, but go right to your motives. Are you rebelling against the king? And they just go right for his motives. And that one hurts. Years ago, I was at a church staff elsewhere and had a couple of my staff. They didn't like me. And one day they stood in my office and said, "Jim, we just think you're arrogant and you're building your own kingdom." Now, I can deal with, I don't preach well. I can deal with, I made a wrong decision. But how do you defend your motives? No, I'm really quite humble. I mean, you can't do this. Right? And it's painful. But you are left powerless when you go after somebody's motives, right? And it happens all the time. Like you question a leader's decision, and they come back at you just like they did with Nehemiah. "Oh, well, you just have a rebellious spirit." I know spiritual leaders sometimes, that's spiritual abuse, but sometimes they won't receive any criticism, anything critical. They just turn back and say, "It's because you have a rebellious spirit." I mean, that's abuse of leadership. Sometimes you're in a dating relationship, and you want that dating relationship to remain sexually pure until maybe you get married. And all you get back is, "Oh, you must not love me then. You must not love me." Or you forget to take out the trash. I mean, you just innocently forget to take out the trash. And all you get back is, "You really don't care, do you?" You see, there's just... Or you take on an extra project at work. And what do you get from your... Because you want to help the team. And what do you get from your jealous fellow employees? You're just trying to brown nose up to the boss, aren't you? "No, I was actually just trying to help the team." But when they go after your motives, I mean, how do you defend accusations against your motives? Or you start following Jesus, and your friends start saying, you're selling us out, aren't you? Man, you used to like partying with us all the time. Now you're just selling us out, aren't you? I mean, don't you care about us at all?" I mean, it just goes on and on and on. If you're going to criticize somebody, don't go for their motives. But that's exactly where these three guys, who had a lot to lose and resorted to insults, and they also went right after Nehemiah's motives. You're just rebellious. You're a traitor. You're out to upset the king. Well, how do you respond to that kind of thing? I like what the famous pastor, Dr. Richard Halverson once said. The best way to handle criticism is to respond quickly, directly, and sensitively. I know sometimes you can't always respond to your critics. Sometimes it's not possible to respond to your critics. But if it is possible, I think that's generally good advice. You know, at least respond somehow in a proactive way. To respond quickly and directly and sensitively, not hitting back. If you get hit, don't hit back. But on the other hand, don't be passive about this. You need to respond in a way you can. So the very next verse, after they say, "You're rebelling against the king," here's how Nehemiah responds in verse 20. "I answered them by saying, 'The God of heaven will give us success.' We as servants will start rebuilding, but as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. I'm going, go get him, Nehemiah. Way to go, man. Get him. I mean, he just stands his ground. He doesn't, like, cave. He doesn't whimper. He does, in fact, three things. I'm going to take them in reverse order as we close. Three things that allowed Nehemiah to deal constructively with the false accusations against him. First of all, Nehemiah, this will be the hard one to understand, I think. Nehemiah refused their assumptions. Every one of your brutal critics who has a lot to lose is bringing assumptions that they believe, misbeliefs, assumptions behind their criticism. And he confronted those. That's why he ended by saying, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. I mean, they were acting like this is ours now, right? But really, they had just stepped into a vacuum. This had not been theirs for very long in the big picture. So they're operating on this assumption that we have our rights, this is ours. You have to confront the assumptions. You can't always argue that your motives are right. But, I mean, I am impressed that probably Nehemiah could have produced a letter from the king of Babylon, but he didn't do that, and he didn't try to say, I'm not really that rebellious, come on, you guys. He just said, first of all, he challenged their assumption behind their criticism. And it's not unlike our lives. Our lives do change or grow. We can't expect everybody to understand everything about us. And very frequently, and it took me years to understand this, very frequently, the people who criticize you are projecting their own personal pain on you. And that makes them sometimes very vicious because we hate our personal pain. But we take our struggles. You know, I just lost my job, so I'm jealous of everybody else that still has a job. And I just start looking at them critically all the time. And I mean, you project your pain on them, and then you go after them with a vengeance because they represent your issue. Got to be very careful. Here's what Craig Groeschel, in his book, Confessions of a Pastor, he's a famous pastor in America. He said, consider the source. When it comes to your critics, consider the source. And consider the possibility that the jab may have come from an injured heart. Dismiss it and move on. If you don't, you may become the very thing you despise. You cannot be the victim of other people's pain projected on you. And Nehemiah brilliantly sidesteps becoming that victim. In fact, when I'm trying to nurse the pain of being criticized, and even with constructive criticism, 100% true, it still hurts. But it helps me to pray for that critic. And I always have objective people in my life, starting with my wife. She's not afraid to tell me the truth, thank God. And people like Pastor Carter and others that are on my team that I trust to tell me the truth. When I come under criticism, I hurt, I'm not objective, and so I have to go to them and say, please tell me, I mean, are they right or not? Is this just something I'm not seeing or not? They help me sort that through. And then if they say, no, Jim, that's totally them, that's their issue totally, I mean, you're not that way at all, then I kind of can start a journey of saying, "But so God, would you just help them with the pain that they're struggling with that's just making them think irrationally, personally, about this situation." Number two, Nehemiah refocused on the mission. No excuses, no defending his integrity even. There's at times you can clarify misinformation with people's assumptions. There are times where I can't share some things as a pastor. I've had people sit in my office and say, I don't want to convey that this is a critical, I don't get criticized a lot, that you are a dream to pastor. You're an amazing church to pastor. But I have had times where I've had to make a hard decision because I know some information you don't know, and I would be betraying a confidence to tell you, and my integrity is at stake. So I have had conversations in my office back there with people who have criticized decisions I've made, and I've been sitting listening to them and saying, I wish I could tell them something that they don't know, Because if they knew what I know, they would totally agree with what I did. Sure. But I can't tell them. That's tough. And you have to realize that some people are in situations like that. It's easy just to go off on people. But you have to be very, very careful that if you can clarify misconceptions, you do that. You can't always do that. But whether you can clarify misconceptions or not, you always go back to the mission. And I love this about Nehemiah. He just simply said to his critics, we, his servants, will start rebuilding. We're just going to do it because this is what God's called us to do. And at some point, that's what gives you courage to move on in spite of people, you know, who probably can't even be expected to understand the changes you're making in your life. And as long as you know that you've got people you trust that know you well, that are speaking into your life in good ways, and you can filter this stuff out, when you get unfairly accused, at some point you just got to go back to the mission. And I love this. You see this all through the scripture. Moses, when he got criticized, God just brought him back to the mission. I'm going to deliver my people from slavery. When Nehemiah gets criticized, we're going to rebuild the walls. I mean, you need this as much as other people, your critics need this, but you just come back to this. In Forbes magazine a number of years ago, Liz Ryan wrote an article that kind of illustrates this. She said, I don't know who makes the greatest violins in the world, but we'll imagine it's an Italian violin maker named Franco, and that Franco has a studio where 15 or 20 apprentice and journeyman violin makers work alongside Franco, making the most exquisite violins in the world. And then she asks this interesting question. Is Franco happy? And the point of the rest of what I'm going to read is this. When you're a person who's focused on a mission, that's not generally a question you ask. It's irrelevant because you're consumed with the mission. You're not consumed with being happy. You're consumed with the mission. So she goes on to say, if Franco is a world-class violin maker, is he happy? Well, he is alternately ecstatic, frustrated, transported, confused, exhausted, and lost in the zone. And anybody who's ever accomplished anything said, amen. The question is, no, am I happy? I mean, you're just consumed with the mission. And it'll frustrate you one day and make you ecstatic the next day, but the mission is what anchors you. No one would say, she wrote, about Franco or his employees, they're happy. Instead, people in Franco's town would say, those guys live and breathe violins, and people around the world rejoice. Listen, you and I are living and breathing a mission from God that the nations of the world can rejoice. That's why Jesus said, therefore go and make disciples of all nations, and I'm going to be with you to the very end of the age. When it comes down to it, I mean, you are lost if you didn't wake up this morning without a purpose in life. And if you have no purpose for your existence, come to Jesus and find it. I mean, that's why this last week, some of us have been working hard, and we've been giving our money away, and we've been praying, and we've been loving on people, because we want the world to sing with the grace of Jesus. Some of you have been working hard for your companies this week, because you want to honor Jesus with the way you work, and the people you touch, and the lives you lift up and you enrich. We are on a mission. Jesus has called us. He's coming back again, as we heard in the gifts of the Spirit earlier in the service, and he has us just hunkering down. And when people don't understand everything you're doing, they accuse your motives falsely. I mean, you may need to resist their assumptions and clarify, but you certainly have to always refocus on the mission. Just get back to the mission. Just get back to the mission. What's God asked me to do? And am I allowing anybody or any opinion keeping me from doing what I know God has asked me to do? And Jesus said, if we do go and make disciples of all nations, we're a part of his global thing to make the nations sing and the world rejoice with his grace. He says, surely I'll be with you always. And that's where Nehemiah starts. You know, he refused his critics' assumptions. He then reaffirmed the mission. refocused on the mission, and then he reaffirmed God's help. God's help. Because Jesus said, if you go, I'm going to be with you. So this is how Nehemiah actually starts. His critics say, you're rebelling against the king. And Nehemiah said, the God of heaven will give us success. Yeah, I don't even expect you to get it all. But I know God's called me. And I know in this season of my life, I'm to be working for this company. I know for this season of my life, I'm to be really focusing on caregiving with an elderly parent. I know in this season of my life, I know I may disappoint you. I know may this or that. But you stay refocused on the mission. You don't buy into everybody else's assumptions about you. You stay focused on the mission, and you reaffirm that God's going to be your helper. As they aim at his motives, you're traitors. You're just trying to rebel against the king. In response to that, the first thing Nehemiah says, oh, but God's going to help me. Isn't that awesome?
Amen.
How awesome. May God give us grace to do that. It's a powerful moment when we put our reputation in God's hands and say, he's going to take care of me. Here's our last verse, verse 23 of 1 Peter chapter 2. It's describing Jesus. It's the verse I read earlier in communion. Or it's the verse before the verse I read in communion. Peter's talking about Jesus hanging on the cross. He said, when they hurled insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He'll even the scales eventually. And there are just days. You have to entrust your reputation and your well-being and your future to him and leave it at that. May God help you do that. I want you to bow your heads, close your eyes.